Seems to me I'm just about the only observer in this highly theoretical crowd, or maybe not. But on top of it, I'm also a radio astronomer, not an optical type, so it's really sort of way off. But still, I try to, what I would like to do is to try to make some sort of a connection with you, and the bridge to do that will be neutron star planets, just one particular system. So I will really try to make it quick, and I really want to tell you what is it that I've been doing, or we have been doing with my collaborators on that system recently. But again, because I'm an observer and a radio astronomer, some things may be not entirely familiar to you, so I will just start with a very quick introduction, and then I will end with the latest data that I actually took the last two nights and the last week in this planetary environment here, remotely observing at Arecibo. And the data actually turned out to be very, very entertaining. Okay, so pulsar planets, radio pulsar planets, are observed with the method that is called pulsar timing. It's related to both astrometry and Doppler spectroscopy, depending on how you want to interpret it. And the only difference is that it is tremendously precise compared with the other two methods. That is, with the microsecond precision of pulsar timing, you can actually attempt to find asteroids around neutron stars, I mean large asteroids. So you don't have to sort of, you know, be observationally restricted to Jupiters and worry about lots of things. Although there are also a lot of things to worry about here, just as well as you will see in a moment. So here's an almost current state of affairs. What you're looking at is the radio timing residuals. That is the differences between the models that predict pulse arrival times and actual observations for three situations. As you see, we started to observe this guy in 1990, shortly after the discovery. Then some time around here, we realized there must be planets around that pulsar, and it was announced, and then we just went on and on and on with the long three-year break here caused by the Arecibo upgrade. The telescope was down. That's the only instrument that can actually do this pulsar at the precision required to study subtle effects like asteroids or perturbations. So, you know, for 3 years, we just had to go and do something else. But then the telescope came back in 97, and we are now in business again and sort of even better than before. So if you just fit a standard timing model to the timing data for this millisecond pulsar, it has a 6 millisecond period actually, then you are left with residuals that actually show you the presence of those two terrestrial mass planets. There's also a third one, but it has a very low signal amplitude. It's only ±3 microseconds, so you won't see it on this this huge scale here. If you take out the three planets, what you're left with is actually perturbations between the two larger terrestrial mass planets. They're close to the 3-2 mean motion resonance, and as Fred and his colleagues and Renu Malhotra and her colleagues predicted in 92, you should be able to see perturbations caused by the MMR existing in the system, and indeed you see it very well. Of course, you really need this baseline of many years worth of data to see all this. It was not like that at the very beginning, but now we get all these things quite neatly and easily. And as you see, observations like that require microsecond precision of the timing, because the amplitude here is ±20 microseconds. So this is the sort of level of accuracy that we are playing with here. Okay, when you take out perturbations, and we have a model for that, a three-parameter model that I will tell you about briefly in just a moment. Then, and if you take out propagation effect, propagation-related effects, that is, you have three electrons along the line of sight that causes the dispersive delay of the radio signal, and it changes in time as the line of sight of the pulsar traverses the medium and various irregularities, and so that produces varying pulse arrival times that you have to model out of this by direct observation. So when you take that out too, You get very nice sort of 3 microsecond RMS residual. So this actually tells you, or me too, that the model, including 3 planets and perturbations and all the pulsar-related parameters, works very, very well. So where are we now in terms of the description of the system? Here is the comparison of the system with some representative planets, I mean hot and cooler Jupiters around normal stars. So planetary masses are about twice the mass of the Moon and four times the mass of the Earth, 3 planets. 2 of them directly or almost directly confirmed by the detection of perturbations. The third one, well, if the two look real, then there's nothing wrong with thinking about the third one in real terms too. But it's really lightweight, roughly two times the mass of the Moon. Then the it's a compact system. The orbits sort of almost fit into the orbit of Mercury. An interesting thing is that despite the fact that it is actually the pulsar that somehow produced those planets, and despite the fact that the evolution of the protoplanetary disk there to give the planets had to be somehow different to some extent from what we think happens in around normal stars, it ended up producing the system that is amazingly similar to the inner solar system. That is, if you, what I mean here is that if you scale the sizes of the orbits here by a factor of 2, you make them overlap with the orbits of Mercury, Venus, and Earth almost exactly. So it's like the universal application of Bode's law, or Bode's law at work, you know, for all kinds of systems. Of course, I'm joking here, but it certainly tells you that initial conditions don't have to be very close from one case to another, even in such extreme cases, to give you a planetary system that is actually quite similar to what we know from home here. Yes? Eccentricities are very, as far as the inner one is concerned, we don't know. The signal is too low to measure it. It's probably almost zero because it's very close to the pulsar. Here it's around 0.02 for both of them. So it's terrestrial, really. Yep. Well, that's actually a very sort of tough question. If you go by the method which is a standard in estimating the ages of millisecond pulsars, it would be around a billion year old system. But it's not clear at all whether that system is that old, because it's an isolated millisecond pulsar, and you know, we would have to go into quite a bit of millisecond pulsar evolution business here to argue that that pulsar could have been created in some sort of accretion-induced collapse or an event like that, and that might mean that it's actually quite young. So could be 10 to the 8 years, perhaps, sort of just enough time to create a planetary system. We really don't know that. We just don't know enough about the physics of the formation of isolated millisecond pulsars, as opposed to binaries, where we think we know quite a bit, right, Fred? Well, he's thinking. Okay, it's no. All right, fine. That's okay. We can talk about that later. Yeah. So it's really unclear how what sort of it could be a billion years old system, could be sort of a factor of 10 younger, something like that. Okay. then we have also integrated the system over a billion-year timescale to see what's going to happen with it. It's quite stable. It's actually stable. What you may find interesting is this is, I think, this radio mouse that does. What you may find interesting is that the simulations show that it actually exhibits the secular apsidal resonance, the SAR or whatever you call it, and it's very well established. And my understanding is that there are now several other systems around normal stars that exhibit the same phenomenon. So the question is that something that is actually common and somehow causally linked from one system to another, or it's just an accident? Amplitude is plus minus 50 degrees.
No, I mean for the distance of the altitude.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's where we are where we are right now. As I said, perturbations can be parameterized in terms of the masses of the two planets that are engaged in perturbations and the mutual inclination or orientation of the orbits. So Maciej Konacki and his colleagues have actually come up with a nice semi-analytical model that could be incorporated in the timing model, and so we actually fitted out the perturbations visible in the data with this model, and that actually gave us those two masses that are now known with something like 5% accuracy. So those are real masses, not the projected masses. And in fact, it's really the first measurement of terrestrial masses anywhere outside the solar system, if you allow me to do a little bit of propaganda here. And from that, of course, we have inclinations of the orbits for free. They are both very close to 50 degrees, within a few degrees, so it's really a coplanar system, which is actually an interesting piece of information because it really suggests that the origin of the system is a disk evolution, not just some sort of a totally freakish incident that would involve some sort of a strange capture or something. It's just a decent disk evolution that... That's right, yes. No, this is the absolute inclination to the plane of the sky. The mutual inclination is 4 degrees or something like that.
No, I mean not that positive,
that is the mutual inclination. Or what is the professional name for that?
Obliquity.
No, obliquity?
Well, usually.
Okay. So I just call it mutual orientation, just to play it safe, but what... it's around 1.4, 1.35 solar masses, probably. Fortunately, it could even be 1.5 or something, and it still wouldn't matter that much. The whole calculations here are not very sensitive to the pulsar or the mass of the central object, fortunately.
But you really don't know.
No. No, the assumed mass is 1.4.
Sorry?
The assumed mass, of course, is 1.4. But what it really is... Well, maybe there's a way to figure it out. Okay, just to rush through everything even faster. There is this reasonably well-defined tiny planetary system. And of course, the next question is there anything beyond the orbit of the outer planet? I think we know that there are no Jupiters there. If we had any, we would have seen that long ago in the manner similar to what we see in the M4 pulsar, that is because of the dynamical influence of a distant object on the observed spin of the pulsar. So you would see non-zero derivatives, higher order derivatives of the spin period caused by the presence of some distant orbiting object. We don't see that at all. And we already have 12 years worth of data. So there are no Jupiters on, say, 10, 20, or even 100 AU orbits out there. So we know that. So then the next question is that perhaps with this high precision of timing that we have, we could actually go after really small objects, like try to detect an asteroid belt around the inner system, if anything like that exists in there, and try things like that. For quite a while, for several years actually, we've been making noises about the Pluto-like object on the wide orbit around the system. And fortunately, we didn't get the idea to publish. I mean, we did get the idea to publish it, but we have not, and that was actually good, because it turns out that the effect that we saw in the data is a propagation effect, not the Keplerian effect. I'm sorry. what I'm saying is that because of the changing electron column density of electrons along the line of sight, you get this variable dispersive delay in pulse arrival times. And it turns out that that fourth planet that we saw is only seen in low frequency data, but not in the high frequency data. Dispersion scales like wavelength squared, meaning that the amplitude between the observing frequencies that we use or have been using all the time, 400 and 1400, there should be a factor of 10 in the magnitude of the dispersive delay effect in the data. That is, it should be 10 times smaller in the high frequency data than it is in the low frequency data. So this is the low frequency data that show the effect that sort of, I mean, it really looks periodic. If you fold these two wiggles, one on top of the other with a 7-year period, you get something like this. So at some point we were thinking that perhaps, I mean, we thought that this separation here, these separations here are equal, but the spacing between them is not the same. So it sort of looked like accumulation of some material in some distant orbit around L4, L5, and L5, driven by some small Pluto-like object in the same orbit, and that would actually be a very attractive solution for many for many reasons. Again, we're pretty close to publishing this speculation, but we haven't, and that turned out to be a good idea. That one could speculate about. So I guess that's it. Thank you very much. Looks like, oh, yes. It's searches for planets are a byproduct of the routine timing of pulsars that are being found. So one doesn't really need to, you know, make a special effort or devise a special program to do this. When you find a pulsar, the first thing you do, you start timing it to figure out the basic parameters, and then the cases that are more interesting than the other cases do get a lot of more attention and are usually timed over long periods of time. So in such a process, planets like this would be unraveled very, very easily. The problem is the it must be absolutely, yes. And but there is a catch in all this. That is, in the world of normal stars, the radial velocity people have something like 2,000 plus stars to look at, and you don't really have to make a special effort to actually discover those stars. In this case, millisecond pulsars are a relatively rare variety, and those isolated millisecond pulsars that this stuff comes from are there are only 10 of them out of the 50 known, roughly 50 known millisecond pulsars in the field, not counting those in globular clusters. So even if the statistics of planet formation are similar or were similar for the two varieties, finding them here would be much, much harder because the statistics are against us. I mean, the numbers of possible candidates are really low and they are difficult to find. So it's going to take quite a while to find the second one like this. Of course, it would help a lot, but so far, no luck.
You might expect if you had two planets that reach four Earth masses, that there'd be about four Earth masses in the next little bin, right? Now, if it's spread out, it would be hard to measure, I guess. But are there any constraints on how much mass you could put in the ring of material beyond the outermost planet?
From the amplitude of that effect, you get, assuming sort of the 1 AU sphere full of some material.
Or a disk.
But effectively, let's just say that the volume would be just like in the 1 AU radius sphere, whatever the real geometry. That would give you something like 10 to 16 grams of mass, of excess mass over whatever we see in over the
total mass,
but then again, that again depends on the degree of ionization of of the material, of chemistry, of course, too. So that would be like a lower limit, I would say, 10 to 16. So I think it's cometary or something like that, isn't it?
There was an upper limit on grains from infrared observations. It's pretty damn low.
Yeah.
I mean, again, we're seeing something, it seems like, that suddenly stops, right? And the corporate's all talking, we don't have much material, we have a bunch of planets, and the system stops. I wonder if the system is just stopping here, and if so, what?
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
I guess I'm asking how much.
You don't know.
Yeah. It'd be hard to measure a ring, I think, because it would be precessions rather than that you see rather than.
So in other words, you're saying that it's probably the material that is spread more evenly and it stops.
The dynamicists must have thought about what people have estimated, for example, in the Kuiper belt, how much mass you can put out there without affecting the orbits of that are closer in. Now there you can look at precession of known estimates. It's much more difficult. I'm just wondering if you can say there's less than equivalent amount of mass equal to one of those planets beyond the system or not.
Okay, so as I said, from this excessive numbers of electrons along the line of sight, you get very, very low masses, 10 to 16. Well, pushing it, you could get to 10 to 20, probably.
Couldn't that correspond to very, very low ionization? Or do you think not?
Here it's particles. It's not photons, really, that probably do the work. So a lot depends on the optical depth of, say, the dust. If there is a dust there, if it's optically thin, that the efficiency of the pulsar beam in ionizing stuff there is very low. So it has to be optically thick for the wind particles to actually hit something or have a good chance to hit something. So, and that we don't know. It's we actually have XMM project. We are also writing a Chandra proposal, because the thing is that magnetic fields out there are still quite high. It's sort of 0.1 to 1 Gauss at 4 AU. So it could be that compression of the field and its interaction with the wind particles could produce soft X-rays that we could detect with XMM. So in other words, this is certainly something that should be looked at in over the whole range of wavelengths, and maybe we'll see something that is, or get more constraints from other types of observations. And then, I guess, answering questions like yours will probably be more satisfying.
In a related question, do you want to list your favorite scenarios for the formation of the system?
Yeah.
It's rare, so what happened?
There are two. One is that Fred likes, the other one is that he doesn't care about, I think. But I like both of them, actually, as sort of competing, but rather similar scenarios. One is the white dwarf merger. That is, you start out with the tight system of two white dwarfs that lose the orbital energy by gravitational radiation, spiral in, merge, and then the denser one disrupts the less massive one, and that way you can very quickly get a very massive disk around a newly formed neutron star if the thing gets pushed through the Chandrasekhar limit, and that's needed because we are seeing a pulsar here. So that's a nice idea, because you really do need a dense disk formed quickly to get to sort of shield the disk or its outer parts from the X-ray flux, accretion flux from the pulsar that will exist for quite some time. And it's a good scenario in yet another aspect or respect, which is that those systems are clearly rare. And from the numbers of overmassive white dwarfs that we know about, we know that they are rare too, right? So it sort of makes sense. Another scenario that is a little more dramatic perhaps, but quite interesting too, is the one that has been around for many, many years. Sterl Finney and Brad Hansen and also Philip Podsiadlowski were people who have been toying with this. The idea there is that you again start with a tight binary, but say it's an evolved binary that consists of of a helium core that is just about to go off and a normal evolved star with it. And so the helium core goes off asymmetrically, as they normally do, and the random kick sends it through the companion star, which of course gets disrupted, and that way you very quickly get a nice disk of protoplanetary material to play with. So, and again, a scenario like this is not something that could happen every day and to every single pulsar. It has to be rare.
Now, the companion to the helium core that explodes has what properties, characteristics, mass?
Well, it's just the regular star. I thought that it could actually still be in the giant stage, but I think when we talked with Fred about that, he was right by saying that it's more probable that it's just a normal star. It still could be a main sequence object. Yeah, actually they are not like this, they're more like that. So it's about a 50 degree or 45 degree angle between the plane of the orbit and the spin axis of the pulsar. And that's again okay, because in an asymmetric explosion of a neutron star, the axis gets kicked in some direction. So generally you don't end up with a nice, elegant 90 degree.
Yeah.
That's right, and it's certainly not like that. We know that from observations.